My name is Dorothy Bass. I'm a church history professor, as you'll find out some during this session, at Chicago Theological Seminary, which is a seminary of the United Church of Christ, which is my denomination. I'm married to a Lutheran, and we live in Valparaiso, Indiana. He teaches at Valparaiso University, and so we are within the orbit of Lutheranism, too. I've called this session Living Traditions of Protestant Christianity. And recently I've become interested in reclaiming the idea or the concept of tradition. This is in some ways a thankless task because the word probably summons up something conservative or let's just hang on to the past to many people. Is that part of your notion of tradition? Okay, I'm going to try to show a different way of thinking about it, which I hope is valuable. As a church historian, it's been exciting to me since childhood to think of my own Christian journey as part of an ongoing journey of the clouds of witnesses, those persons who have gone before us in faith, and also to be aware that there are just as many, presumably, coming after us. Okay, so that tradition is, in a sense, the river that flows from the past of the Christian heritage and on into the future, and which changes over time. And I want to see our time, claim our time as part of that river from the past into the future. My plan is, first of all, to try to develop a concept of what it means to belong to a living tradition, and then to suggest some of the things that we can learn from the varieties of forms of Christian faith within different traditions of Christianity. Let me start with a story. This is from the novel Giants in the Earth. Do some of you know that novel? By Ole Rolvaag, who wrote the novel in 1925. He was born in Norway. Emigrated to South Dakota to join his uncle on a farm when he was a teenager, and became very fascinated with what it meant to be a Norwegian in America, and became the professor of Norwegian literature at St. Olaf College. I was hoping this might be an example that some Holden people could relate to. And wrote this novel about the experiences of the immigrant generation. He's writing about the 1870s, writing in the 1920s about the 1870s. And I'm reading from near the end of the novel. Early on, we learn all about the hardships, for some the excitement, for others the terror of building a new community on the Great Plains, which is very different from the mountains and hills and the fishing villages of Norway, out to this great expanse, which some experience as a land of opportunity and others experience as the devil's land, is just so different and frightening and terrifying. And by the time we're this far along in the novel, the characters have developed various forms of estrangement from one another and from God. They have their own stories are laden with certain kinds of guilt, certain kinds of hope, and they're working through their problems in this way. And at this point, a stranger rides into the village, the cluster of sod huts there on the prairie, and comes and knocks at the door, and they're wondering who he is at first, but he says, "I'm a minister." And the ones to whom he comes just weep. They're just so thrilled to be reached out to in this way and to have this reminder of where they come from and to be in touch with their faith again. And that afternoon he says, "Summon everyone. Bring them into the largest hut, and we're going to have worship service." And I'm going to read two paragraphs describing the worship service. The minister stood in the corner next to the window, arrayed in full canonicals. The gown was threadbare and badly wrinkled as a result of its many journeys inside the old valise. The ruff might have been whiter, perhaps, but such trifles were not noticed now, for here stood a real Norwegian minister in ruff and robe. It is undoubtedly true what Tonsaten had said about him. He was an altogether remarkable man. The vestments which he wore seemed only to emphasize the strength of his features, whose youthful vigor, in spite of the gray-streaked beard, appeared at this solemn moment to have taken on a new glow of life. The table, spread with a white cloth, had been placed so close to the window that the minister barely had space to stand behind it. On the table stood two homemade candles, one at either end. The candlesticks, too, were homemade, cut from 2 4-inch pieces of sapling, with the bark left on and painted white. At a little distance, they looked like a curious work of art. The candles were not yet lighted. A Bible and a hymn book lay between them. And it goes on, and he preaches to them about how their journey is like the journey of the Israelites into Canaan, and that they need to wonder whether they will be like the 10 tribes from whom we never hear again, or like the 2 tribes who persevere in their faithfulness. And it's a challenge to them, and the people are very deeply moved by this. Now, as I hear this passage, one of the things that stands out is, you know, here stood a real Norwegian minister in ruffin robe, and the way in which they're trying to recreate the symbolic arrangement of home with the candles and the hymn book and the white cloth in a sod hut on a prairie, you know, so far from home. And they're deeply moved by this. And the minister's even wondering if it's working at all, but the people are deeply moved by this. And in a sense, they're longing for their past, right? I mean, they're longing for home. They're experiencing home in this. And they want the vestments to be just the same, right? And they want the candles to be there. And they want it all to be Norwegian, right? And I think that they're gratified that it is in a certain way. And in that sense, it's a conservative move on their part. I mean, it's a looking back, it's a grasping for the old. But in this event, and in countless others like it, on the Great Plains and everywhere else in this country and then in other countries, a new tradition also gets born, or the tradition gets advanced, right? That what was once Norwegian now has an American setting. And there are probably grandchildren of these people, and these are fictional people, but there are grandchildren of these people in this village at this moment, you know, learning to sing hymns that don't use masculine-dominated language, right? So in a sense, that receiving of the old has become an opportunity. I mean, Rolf Vogtsgård teaches St. Olaf, and it's St. Olaf. They were not doing things now like they did then. But there's a continuity through time, right? And a refounding of the tradition in this new place for this new time, which has led on to Holden Village, you know, some of those people. So what started as a conservative move actually is a growth into the future in this case. And in the process, the Lutheran tradition that's represented here is perpetuated, yes, and does have real ties to the old country, but it also takes on some newness and is permitted to continue to grow on into the future in its new place. Okay. Now, Luther said lots of things, but one of them is, we all have to do our believing like our dying alone. You know, and there's some existential truth in this. I mean, there's the personal faith and the personal trust in God at the deepest moments of faith. But it seems to me very clear that we also live. We acquire and develop and experience our faith within very specific communities, which are social and which take on class and ethnic arrangements. Okay? I mean, it mattered that these Christians, like all Christians, had a certain element of faith, but these were Norwegian ones who wanted the candles a certain way. Right? And we all come into faith, whether as children or we join up later on, with a specific social form, right, which we call the church. Not the abstract church, but the real church where you put the candles a certain way, right? And through language and through forms and I don't know how much you travel from one denomination to another. I do a fair amount, but people talk different one place than they do in another. Right? And it's beautiful to kind of understand that. To me, it's exciting to me because I think that each one has something special to offer to the others. But on the other hand, each one by itself can seem limited. I mean, if this is just for Norwegians, that's not the full message of the Christian faith, right? Okay. But these people did enter Christian faith in that way and become enabled to grow on further beyond that. There's one more paragraph I want to read about their sense of the tradition to which they belong. And it's social embodiment. They take it so much for granted the church needs to be a certain way. The people sat and stood about while he was preaching, hanging on every word he said. Only a few were competent to climb the ladder of reasoning that he had raised for them. The others realized that he was preaching well and let it go at that. It gave them a simple satisfaction just to listen. They rejoiced in their hearts that such a man had come here today. They felt that he wished them well. And it was so fine and jolly, too, this gathering together. Now there would be some excitement in the settlement. One was thinking about the congregation that they would have to organize, another about the location of the new church, still another about the cemetery as to where it would probably be located. And to everyone, the thought came that men would be needed to manage these activities. Well, they would show him that they could govern themselves, that they were a well-conducted people. One woman had it in mind that they would, of course, start a ladies' aid now that they had a minister, and that it would be great fun with meetings and cakes and coffee and sewing and all the rest. She proposed to begin some embroidering at once. But those who had not yet been confirmed dreaded the ordeal a little, though at the same time they were glad. At any rate, there would be a change in the daily monotony, and they would, of course, have fine new clothes for the confirmation. They take for granted a certain social form, and you can hear the conventionality in it, and this may not be revolutionary global faith, but on the other hand, this is the way in which they get brought into the tradition and from which they can grow. Even hidden within this, it can sound smug, it can sound settled. But, there was a time when the tradition contains some self-correctives upon itself. There was a time when even having a ladies' aid was a new and radical idea for the women in the church to organize. I mean, so there's that within the tradition, even though it's smug, it's pointing to the old country, there's a tradition of conflict and emergence. Within this, there's a sense of lay leadership. They're going to need our leadership, right? Which at one time, before the Reformation, was not welcomed. And so there's a tradition, within the tradition, there are conflicts, they're the history of conflicts, they're the history of advances embodied within it. You can read back old conflicts into this new one, and you can see new conflicts coming. And we live in that kind of place, I think, as Christians. So when I think about tradition, I think about a conversation and a movement that is ongoing from before till into the future, that has a social form, which in the Christian tradition is the church, which takes place across time and across space, and which includes conflict and change within it. It is what we receive, it is what we pass on, but the part I want to lift up is that every generation leaves its mark and leaves its imprint on the tradition, if the tradition is alive. So that, and we do this often by highlighting a new element that's there but has not been properly spoken out, by bringing the tradition into a new context. And this is happening now. And having laid this out, let me get you to offer some, to respond to some examples. It's possible that one of the major changes and the major imprints upon Christian tradition which my generation, our generations will make, has to do with changes in the relation between men and women within the tradition. Now some people hear these changes and say, that's against the tradition. Or you can say, this is a tension within the tradition, we're highlighting a new element which is there and bringing it into greater prominence in the next phase, but that's proof that it's a living tradition and not a dead tradition. You can say the tradition is the, is it the dead faith of the living or the living faith of the dead? You see, you can see the, these things as within the tradition and acknowledge that every generation has made its impact in some way, and seeking to be very conscious that it's not, you know, that we're looking to future generations as well as to past generations. Okay? Or you can say that's against the tradition. The sometimes tradition changes when it's brought into a new context, so that, for instance, in some of the countries where there are younger Christian churches, which have been mission churches, in Asia, for instance, you know, for the first years in the 19th century, there was some kind of a mimicking of Western European Christianity, of that of the Europeans that brought it, but now it's being contextualized. And it's exciting to Taiwanese Christians, whom I know, to be able to say, we will use rice in the communion. That's exciting. It's different for us. And I don't see this as a departure from tradition, but rather as a proof that this is a living tradition and that many other generations in the past have made similar impacts upon the tradition. I mean, Luther made a big one.
Mm-hmm. When you say the use of rice in communion, mm-hmm. is that instead of bread?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the name of the fruit, but in the, you know, in the Pacific Islands, there's a certain fruit that is, that they speak about. If anyone, do you know the name? I mean, there's, and you'll even read, hear hymns and hear about theology spoken of that way. I should have looked that up. I didn't think to. Yes, but to say we'll use our indigenous stuff to speak the truth about body and blood, and we'll do that, and it's, and there's a, an extension of the tradition to that by that, and it becomes alive in a new place. Okay. Since I'm on the edges of the ELC, maybe you could comment more. But it seems to me there's a real effort in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America now to move beyond that ethnic identification of Lutheranism, which has been very strong in sustaining the Lutheran tradition historically in the United States, I'd say at least until about the Second World War. The ethnic communities and even the divisions between the synods tended to be ethnic. Right? And that to be a to keep your Norwegian heritage is to keep your is to keep going to the Lutheran Church, and these things could be very much wrapped up with each other. And there seems to me there's an effort to move beyond that, which has a lot of strengths and also creates some pain for people. Any comments? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Under the category of church, I think I hear you talking about maybe a couple kinds of traditions, the theological tradition, mm-hmm. and also the social tradition.
Right.
And I think that the social traditions at times are much more difficult to mm-hmm. Get outside of and beyond them, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of identity wrapped up in them.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I think you're right. I'm talking about both theological and social traditions, but I want to claim that it's very hard to separate them because tradition always comes to us in a social form.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard. And the question is, how can that become a strength as well as a weakness to our faith? I mean, rather than just hemming us in, it also can become something that keeps growing. So that, for instance, we could create new social forms that didn't have the liabilities of ethnic forms, but they still would be social forms. Wouldn't they? I mean, I think the ELCA is trying to do that. Or Holden's probably trying to do that with rainbows and all of that.
But in reaching out to another ethnic group, mm-hmm. you know, let's say we're talking about white Midwest Protestant, reaching out to black, mm-hmm. very a different kind of expression altogether.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very hard to blend those two mm-hmm. together and say we're going to sit on the same pew and get as much out of each other's services as if it were our own. Mm-hmm. And these social things are tremendously difficult. Mm-hmm. I don't talk about color.
No, they
are. Being a way of expressing themselves.
Right.
And their own mm-hmm. social fabric. You know, it's just very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you see democracy as within or against the tradition of the churches? Because it seems to me that both the feminist role mm-hmm. and the changes in the Roman Catholic Church and so forth are struggling with this question of, do we really believe yes. in democracy? And yet the church has many times been the champion of democracy mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For government, but not for itself
right.
that much. And so I'm just wondering, is it against the Christian tradition or within the Christian tradition to really believe in democracy all the way, even within the church?
Do you mean that we should now vote on what we believe or don't believe, or democracy in that?
No, I see it's an ambiguous uh-huh. term.
May I try? Does it have to do with individualism? Or
I grew up in the social context of uh-huh. Byzantine non-democracy.
My problem uh-huh. grows out of the fact that 50 years ago, within the church, I learned at a conference about the meaning of democracy as a reverence for human personality mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. this concern mm-hmm. for people.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Would lead to a democratic society.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really thrilled by this.
Yeah.
But for 50 years, I've been struggling within my church.
Yeah.
Because my church is not as democratic as the organizations I had been working
uh-huh.
with,
uh-huh.
and I've been a misfit mm-hmm. in the church for mm-hmm. all these years because I want a democratic uh-huh. organization. And
yeah, well, let me try this. I do think I would tend to use words like participatory. I mean, hoping to find social forms that are participatory, which might be different from democratic.
It could be autocratic and participatory.
But also, the question of individualism is another one. I think that one of the ways in which I find tradition helpful in my own sense of my faith is to... I'm a historian, or I'm attracted to history, so maybe not all people will understand this. But the sense of having emerged from somewhere, not just being a woman of 1991, but of having come from somewhere and having responsibility for future generations too. So that one of the definitions of tradition is the democracy of the generations, in the sense that we care for the earth, for the future, not just for ourselves, that we receive as much as we can from the past and we think about the future, and not just think about, you know, my own individual claims. I don't know. That's one of the ways you've been trying to get in, too.
I think the traditions change with necessity of the mm-hmm. economics and so forth so mm-hmm. much. And I think of the Catholic Church right now mm-hmm. struggling. You know, the priest never marries because he emulates the life of Jesus, supposedly never married, but they're running out of priests.
Right. And priests did marry until 1200.
Mm-hmm. So,
you know, tradition. So the tradition, if you're talking about tradition, a more expansive yeah. sense of tradition would point in that direction.
And now we find the yeah. churches are struggling with homosexual
mm-hmm.
sexuality
mm-hmm.
within the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The churches have struggled with a lot in the past, too, and I think that to see some of the, to find some of those resources and so on is helpful. Any?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I learned some wonderful patriotic things in the Methodist Church when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I like what he said, because we didn't make a lot of difference between our attitude toward the church and toward our country.
Yeah.
It was kind of
yeah.
all rolled up in the same thing. But where I came a cropper was with capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
The greed that's connected mm-hmm. with what I call capitalism, mm-hmm. or whatever mm-hmm. that is, that's where I really have trouble. And
And so I don't see the problem. You see, I'm not an Episcopalian, and so we still have this kind of patriotic attitude. And boy, the Gulf War really split our congregation clean right down the middle. Mm-hmm. What we did was not talk about each other because we were so polarized that we didn't dare.
Now, think about how different that would have been in, say, a Quaker group, okay, which is historically pacifist, and where you don't just individually have to be for or against the war. That's part of your social form. Part of your social form is we don't do army. I mean, that's right. I mean, it's right.
But in spite of that, they're a contrast with most of our churches because they are so democratic that they act by consensus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're just almost gone. I mean, there are, not very many left. Some new recruits are always attracted to that message.
I think I made the mistake of making an absolute of this pacifism.
Well, no, but that's who they are.
I know.
That's who they are. And what about in Mennonites? Okay. Same thing. We can, my church, the United Church of Christ, will pass peace statements every time they get a chance. But I'm sure that the registrations for the draft and the recruitment and so on is just as high as you see as it is in, the Mormons or the, the Catholics or the secular world. So that we make statements, but it's not necessarily embodied into our social form. And the social form, which is a community that practices peace, is a different thing from, that's why I think the social form and the theology need to somehow go together. The Mennonites can, they remember in their families, each one, somebody who was persecuted for, somebody who was killed for not fighting back in a crime situation or in a settlement situation. Okay, they remember in their family somebody who was hounded for being a conscientious objector. So it's a different tradition there that has more force than just belief. And that's so how we can create social forms as well as theological statements is an interesting question to me. Mm-hmm. But in the way in the back.
Yeah, I was wondering, the social forms and you said social forms fit in with theological forms, and how confusing that can be in the sense that theology talks about reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been saying that reality is hierarchical and that nature is hierarchical. And yet, we create social forms that are more democratic and horizontal. And the integration of those is a cross upon which we're all
crossing. Yes,
That you can't deny one, try to make one fit onto the other is a challenge, it's a crossroads.
Go ahead.
The interesting to me is what Bill brought up in terms of we don't make changes until we're forced to, one way or the other. And yet, it would be hopeful for me that the church would be the vanguard of making certain changes, social changes.
Mm-hmm.
But we are so busy protecting the old that we're not really out there scratching around looking at the new, And I think that's not a good comment for the Christian faith.
Does everyone agree? Do you see the church always that?
I don't agree with that at all.
Say something.
I think there is certainly some truth to the idea that in some senses of the church, that it's a bastion of tradition or...
You're not allowed to use that word.
Not a lot of bastion.
Of the past.
I don't...
What's your language?
Still a place where there is very slow change or opposition to change or whatever. And I don't think that's necessarily true. Even if you think of... the ELCA in forming a new church has attempted to do a lot of things that are a very different kind of form. For example, you talked about a commitment to multicultural, becoming a more diverse and multicultural church. That is not just saying we will reach out to people who have not normally been part of our church, there has been a commitment made to having place provided for people who have not been part of the decision-making process in the church in the past. And that has meant some people who traditionally have been used to being at that table formulating the decisions have had to stand aside to make space for someone new. Mm-hmm. Now that's a very radical kind of effort. Mm-hmm. And it's been very painful and mm-hmm. difficult, and there's a very strong desire to pull back from that commitment and so on. But mm-hmm. there are lots of different things that happen in the church. Mm-hmm. I think also the church can be, at times, a place where people will look at threatening or difficult issues a little more freely than they might.
Is potential, you know, is threatening. I mean, there are characters in the, I mean, I've been to church where the lectionary will include an incredibly radical prophet, you know, statement, and something, you know, a couple of others, and we'll go to that Pauline, this is my characterization of some Lutheran preaching, we'll go to that Pauline aphorism, you know, the statement of be true to the faith or something like that every time, and overlook some of the other parts, but the other parts are there, and people do deliberately go and listen to them, and admit that they have sin, which they may not take to heart every time, but which American culture wants to tell them they do not have. Right? So that's, but it's a, you know, it's definitely a mixed blessing. It's the treasure in earthen vessels motif, that there is a treasure there, whether or not it's, sometimes the earthen vessel caps it up. You wanted to say more, I'm sorry.
One thing I was wondering about is I noticed that where churches are thriving and really living is where people have still been suffering a great deal. And when we get more comfortable, the churches tend mm-hmm. to, you know, maybe in a sense, I don't know, we try to adapt mm-hmm. and fit all the changes and change with the times, but then people just, after a while, leave the churches. Yeah. There's no real cohesive mm-hmm. force there mm-hmm. created by the real. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, Catholic church is falling apart, but not in Poland, not in Africa. Mm-hmm. It's just something that we're pretty comfortable here, and that part of the struggle in the conquest, we're pretty comfortable. We can afford to go and change churches, and we can afford to change ideas very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think it helps to look at these things locally rather than just in national denominational structures, too. I mean, I get most excited about congregations, not every one of them, but, you know, but what they represent and promise compared to denominational structures. But, you know, there's a lot of variety there. Sometimes we count vitality by how it's going in the national budgets and the national membership rules and so on, when in fact what should be looked at is what's happening to people in congregations.
I have a burning thing here. Being a Lutheran all my life and going into all these different churches from ALC to ELCA, being a member, I have a feeling of insecurity because every time we jump from one group to another in the Lutheran Church, mm-hmm. I have, personally have a feeling of really losing tradition
mm-hmm.
because we worry too much about the argument. Like the ALC versus the LCA, there's two different groups there. Mm-hmm. LCA was more involved with being open with their commitments, where we, being a member of the LCA, mm-hmm. we drew back a little bit. We weren't outspoken as much. And then when they formed the LCA, they were battling. And mm-hmm. I see that the losing tradition.
Okay, let me try to go to my second point about traditions. I think it will address this.
Okay
the and partly, I mean, if you take that little Norwegian Lutheran tradition, that's probably about six mergers ago, right?
Yeah.
Right? So how should they identify their tradition? you know, Norwegian Lutheran, some other couple in, you know, maybe some other little steps in there, to ALC, to ELCA, or we want to talk about Lutheranism as a world confessional family, okay, which is not simply tied to institutional incorporated structures, but Lutheranism as a culture, as a whole movement of theology and church life, or do we want to talk about the Christian tradition, okay, as the tradition that's meaningful? Now, you've been subjected to denominational change because your own congregation probably has moved. Many, many Americans now move themselves from one denomination to another. The sociologists are just fascinated by this. You used to be able to predict what someone would be, you know, and by what their parents were. You can't do this. Here's a what Methodist turned Episcopalian. I was Presbyterian, then UCC, and on the fringes of Lutheranism. There are probably other, any other examples here? Uh-huh.
I was baptized Pentecostal.
Okay.
I was raised Episcopalian and became a Catholic in Ireland.
Okay, great. Oh, great. This is, that's one of the best examples. Okay. Anybody else? You know, and particularly with the way we live in a mobile society and people don't marry within their own groups as much. Okay, and that, you know, that there's all these all different mobility factors, and there's just not as much denominational loyalty as there once was. Okay, on the part of, so that the question of to what extent, say, Lutheranism should seek to perpetuate itself as a tradition, is that an ALC tradition, an ELCA tradition, or some kind of larger Lutheran world confessional family is what they talk, how do they talk about in Geneva at the World Council, or the Christian tradition. You see, there are these different forms of identification that, that we could talk about. And in World Council Church's discussions, ecumenical discussions, they've come to a formulation, which is real simple, but it might be interesting, talking about the tradition with a capital T as the Christian tradition, that by which we are constituted as Christians. And I think it basically means the witness and testimony in person of Jesus Christ and the community that has formed around and been perpetuated by that reality. Okay. And then scripture and other things would be witnesses to that. Okay. But then there are also the traditions. Now, with a small t, which are Roman Catholicism, Orthodoxy, then you could say either Protestantism or the Lutheran tradition, the Reformed tradition, by which I would mean the, those coming from Calvin, Presbyterians, and Reformed, and so on, the Wesleyan tradition, Methodists and others, okay, the Anabaptist or Free Church or Believer's Church tradition, which would include the Mennonites and those who believe in adult baptism. There's a mic. I probably wrote these down somewhere. And then some Anglican. It's a special story. Episcopal tradition. So these are all traditions within the capital T tradition. And the question of to what extent you emphasize your denomination or your place within this is a judgment call. It's a way of understanding oneself. I myself believe very much that all of these have more in common than they have to separate them, even though it's very interesting to say, well, why do you think this about communion and why do we think that? You know, why do you have bishops? We don't. Why do you baptize babies? And those are fascinating questions, but basically I think they have far more in common, and I would honor all of them as genuinely fully Christian, but as each one possessing a certain genius or a certain slant on the faith, some emphasis which was discovered through their own historical experience, which they can then offer
to the others. Mm-hmm. Did you raise a family
And you belong to one church now, and your husband belongs to another church, and you raise a family?
No. We worship together every Sunday.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I was already ordained in my denomination before I met him.
Okay.
And, United Church of Christ. And I was already a seminary professor in that denomination, ordained, and it was not seemly to jump ship. No, I'm very committed to that church, and he to his. So we ordinarily do worship together at a ELCA congregation. So this is interesting. After we were all settled in that congregation, an African American United Church of Christ pastor moved to our town, which is a predominantly white town, to work for a social agency, and said, these people in this town don't need a social agency, they need a church. And he started a United Church of Christ congregation, which has gathered up the black community in our town and made it and it's now the case of the church as the center of the black community. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I'm the treasurer and member, and we go there maybe every third week or so. You can go to Lutheran Church first, and so I got plenty of time to go to this other one. But there we see. I mean, you know, my Lutheran husband can clap and stand up and testify and all that. No way. the children kind of like that church. It's livelier. But those people would be bored to death in the ELCA church, sitting still. And also you can see things. This being part of a brand new church with people who share in common, almost all of them race, not all. There are a lot of white fellow travelers, I would say, to this congregation who show up now and again. Somebody brings forth the first baby to give back to God, as they said. And the pastor calls me up and says, Dorothy, we're going to have a christening on Sunday. Well, Greg, what do you mean by a christening? Well, we're going to give this baby back to God. And I said, well, okay, what do you mean by this? This is a baptism or a dedication. Oh, Dorothy, people have been fighting about that for years. We can't, that's not something to fight about. The point is that this mom wants to give her baby to God. Greg, are you going to have water on the table, or are you not going to have water on the table when you do this? You have to decide. And so you see this congregation has to create its own tradition, identify itself, and the United Church of Christ either would be fully acceptable. It's very much congregational determines, and there are some churches that do infant and some that do adult believers' baptism. So, we had to make a tradition as we went along. From the pieces of tradition that all of us brought with us, and it was a dedication, okay? As I would call it, it was dedication, and not a baptism. No water was used, but there's a very conscious effort to think, okay, what is the right thing for this community? Which most of the time we come in and we just do what's always been done. So it was interesting.
And I want to say that in the ELCA, we also have a lot of that same kind of freedom to be responsive to the community that happens to gather. Mm-hmm. I'm a member of a Mission Start in a community that's very diverse racially. And most of the people who worship in the congregation are from many, many different traditions. So it's been a constant process of certainly being... participating in Lutheran theology, mm-hmm. but being able to incorporate many kinds of traditions mostly in social forms or worship forms. And this is really related, Howard, to a lot of what you said about democracy. I mean, the reason why this Lutheran congregation has been able to flourish in that particular setting is because the leadership of the congregation has come from the community. And in conversation with the pastor has developed a ministry in response to the community there. And that leadership issue is a real key one. Mm-hmm. If the pastor had come in and said, well, I know the right way to be a congregation in this community, and we're going to do it in my way, he wouldn't be there anymore.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I'm hoping for, and this is a great example, is that we can think of tradition as something that we can claim and then work with in making its future. Okay? That we would know if we choose to be Lutheran, you know, if we are given the gift of having been born Lutheran or come into Lutheranism in some way, to know just as much as those people in that new church knew why we're going to baptize this way and not some other way. You know, to make the tradition one's own in that sense, so that we can give an account of ourselves, you know, and also to see that we're not just taking it from the past, but that we know what we're doing, that we bear the tradition ourselves, just as, I mean, Luther bore it and made a big bunch of changes, right? I mean, you know, we also bear it and can carry it into the future in a different form. Though I hope one that is recognizable as a story that continues on from a past into a future. And to see ourselves that way. You do see it very clearly in a new church start, and that's been fascinating to me to be part of that. It was a real gift that came along.
One thing I've seen in the community, because I've visited around a lot of churches, and frankly I've got a denominational mixed up history, but the thing is, I see these churches have been established, and it doesn't matter what denomination, Congregational, Disciples of Christ, or Lutheran, even, and they still have the group that established them, except that group is growing older. And the youth are leaving the church of their family and stuff, and it's always a new congregation that starts up where they're participating like what you say, and I don't care. Mm-hmm. It can be a charismatic, it can be a non-charismatic. Right. It isn't always that extreme, but the kids go off and they start up their own church of young people because they want to have a part in saying what they've got, and that other church belongs to those people that started it, by God.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with denomination at all. But they want to participate in finding the tradition the way they do it.
Right. But they will bring into that, even without realizing it, they will bring in their parts of their old traditions, won't they? When they form that new church?
Oh, yeah.
They won't, yeah.
Yeah,
they
you recognize it. I mean, you have no trouble recognizing
Do you have any fear that we'll lose our traditions?
I have a lot of fear. I think that our society seeks to erode our identities apart from that which is useful and profitable and productive in the consumer society. And I see tradition, if we understand it as part of a story that we belong to rather than as just a burden. That's one of my ways of trying to keep some independence from the other stories of nation, economy, and so on that are calling for my total allegiance.
I have a couple of struggles here. One is that it seems to me that with the growth of the charismatic and the fundamentalist and so forth, and the shrinking of the mainline Protestant churches, that there's a danger of losing a lot of tradition in the name of tradition, because they're spreading to get back to that old time religion. The other question though is that it seems to me that increasingly the church is becoming irrelevant because it is not willing to become ecumenical. But if it were to become ecumenical, then it's a threat to all these traditions.
Well, that's why I think we need to know how we see ourselves in relation to Christian tradition, Lutheran tradition, you know, Protestant, Lutheran. Where is how far down the food chain do you, the denominational chain do you? Now, friends, the United Church of Christ incorporates several very different traditions, and it's very hard on us, you know, in administrative terms. But there's no choice but to say Christian identity is the point. There's no choice. We can't say United Church of Christ identity. I mean, there are a few people who try to do that, but I can't figure out what it means, because we've got Lutherans and Reformed and Congregational and disciple-type people all in there. and ethnic diversity as well. So I think that we have to choose Christian tradition. I do think that there are certain insights which the small t traditions have, which I would like to see each group learn from, but which I wouldn't want to see all washed out. You know, I mean, I think it's good. All Christians may not ever be able to live like Mennonites, but I'll be sad if the Mennonites aren't there to remind us of something, you know. So, yeah.
Well, I think the metaphor that you used for the river was good in that it's, you know, tradition isn't something that we can understand as something that's static.
Right.
If we're going to build dams or partial dams and stop that flow, then that means that certain things won't happen. You know, the salmon won't get upstream, mm-hmm. so to speak. Or,
yeah, right. That's right.
And,
Right, and certain messages won't be there for the future generations. Too. Yeah, that's thanks. I've got both of
you. I keep seeing things all the time, though, that like the Catholics having a problem not having enough priests, and somebody in the group said, well, they used to in 1200, before mm-hmm. 1200, the priests married. Why can't they marry now? And then they would have lots of priests, because there's mm-hmm. lots of men who want to be priests. And I look at it in architecture. We switch, say, uh-oh, we got a pulpit side and another side, and now things have switched around because they were switched years and years ago. One time they were in the middle, and you go to Germany and look at all the Christian churches, and they're on this side, in the middle, and on that side, mm-hmm. depending on mm-hmm. whatever, you know. And we take that stuff in this country, and we just do with it. And somebody says, how come you have the preacher on the wrong side? Well, they used to do it that way.
Right.
The tradition's stronger right. for the old, right. old.
Right. Part of what I'm trying to do is emancipate tradition from that little group of people who runs the church.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's, in a sense, that's what we think of. We think of the heritage of the past is just owned by that group of people. And that's not fair. The Christian past is much more expansive and rich than that. No, and it's exciting. There's some good stuff there, there's some bad stuff, and, you know, go ahead.
The tradition is going to be lost in the church, and young people are going to get involved in the church to try to keep tradition up. Why is it we've got so much apathy and don't have commitment? I work on the church council in Oregon, mm-hmm. and that's a problem we have. We got too much apathy and not enough commitment. When you look around at some of like the Mormons and Joe Witt, they're out there, they're firing, and they're on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. What are we as Orthodox Christians doing wrong that they're doing right?
They never criticize themselves. You never hear them criticize themselves.
That's part of it. I don't think
it's part of our tradition.
How many people could really give an account of why Lutherans present their children for baptism? I mean, I think that the Mormons could give a much better account of themselves, saying things that I don't much like, you know. But they could explain, their laity could explain what they are and why and so on. I mean, they have a very strong educational
right.
program. And I think that the mainstream churches have become lazy in that regard. It's one of the, I mean, we don't think about how hard it is to appropriate. We assume that people know certain things.
Because we have expected young people to come to the church, to let the church raise the teachings of the children instead of the family doing it first and then coming to church.
Nobody can do it in 1 hour.
Nobody's doing it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But that's right. what we're doing wrong, right?
I agree.
Yeah. Well, the adults aren't necessarily fully informed and aligned.
Yeah, we've kind of lost a generation.
I think I need to bring it almost to an end, but there are a couple more comments. Do you want one more?
One of the things I was feeling as part of the conflict is that economically our culture is set up structurally to do away with loyalties and roots.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
You can't keep profane or deep loyalties and keep economically alive.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone has to be transitional and moving around, and that disrupts all communities.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that people turn to God because life's complicated. They want something simple as an answer. And the more complicated the church has become, the theologies and the debates, it self-destructs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When people look at it as self-destruction, mm-hmm. a response to the suffering.
There's some, that's probably right. there is some simplicity at the core of a wonderful communion service, which may not get across either. You know, and if there's always a simplicity there too, which we may not know how to highlight always. You know. So I think I'm supposed to stop now. Thank you. The other sessions I'm going to do have to do with, I'm going to lift up what I take to be the unique gifts of some of these different traditions, like, you know, the Mennonites.
This is just started.
Yes.
Well, should we do another one like this? Okay. Thanks.